Good morning, everyone. I'd like to call to order this hearing of the House Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. It is leap year day, so a day we only get once every 4 years. How about that? A quorum is present, and we're going to be hearing three bills today, and we hope to give them about a half hour each, which, you know, so we're going to ask the testifiers to be succinct so there's time for member discussion with each of the bills. And one announcement before we get started on that, I think we've kind of reached out to the minority about this too, but I think, you know, we really would like to reduce our use of paper in this committee, in part not only because of resources, but because it takes a tremendous amount of staff time and effort to do all the copying and distribution that we do in this committee, and I know you members know we do tons of it. So we're hoping to go digital as much as possible with committee documents. And so Mr. Sandy, our committee administrator, is going to be sending an email to members. So we're going to, going forward, we're going to distribute electronically, not with paper. But if you want the paper, we're going to ask you to respond to Mr. Sandy's email and let him know that. So in other words, it's an opt-out of electronic delivery. If you don't want only electronic, then let him know, and you will continue to get the paper copies. So I hope that's okay with everybody. And then, of course, going along with that, go ahead and bring your computer to committee. Because, you know, you may want to, if you're getting the electronic delivery, you may very well want to pull up the documents. But I think we're going to continue to distribute the actual bills and amendments in on paper, because we know that that is hard to manage often, especially when we don't have a 24-hour rule. You may be getting the paper amendment, looking at it for the first time. So we'll continue to do that. Representative Quam, question on that?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Since they new computers no longer have of where you can do the editing on the screen, I would like to still get the agenda, because then I make notes specifically to the speakers so that when we take questions at the end, that's assistive, if I might have that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, so Representative Plum, I think that would be part of the opt-out that we would, you know, communicate to Mr. Sandy. Fair enough, you know. I mean, different members proceed in different ways, and we're in this big transition period. So watch for the email, and then, you know, if we don't hear from anyone, if we don't hear from you, we will assume that digital works for you. And, you know, this is mainly like testimony that we get. We get many, many written testimony and so on. So, yes, Madam Speaker, I love that.
I know, I just promoted you. Congratulations. I have worked with Democrat members, I've worked with Republican members. If anybody wants a little tutorial on going totally digital, it's the best.
I would like to take you up on
Great,
that.
We'll do it.
Thank you very much. I've been kind of looking for how to do that myself, so thank you. That's good. The paper industry will not be happy with us. Those of us who've been around for a while know this. The timber industry likes us to keep on with the paper. Okay. Anyway, with that, the next order of business is the minutes. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move the minutes from February 22nd, please.
All right. The minutes have been moved. Is there any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The minutes are approved. Thank you, Representative Bierman. So, first bill we will have on the agenda is House Bill 4200. Representative Feist is here. So I will move that House Bill 4200 be re-referred to the Committee on Labor and Industry, Finance, and Policy. So Representative Feist, to your bill.
Right. Thank you so much, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee. As a preliminary point, this bill is not the same bill as the Keeping Nurses at the Bedside Act. So if all of you were very excited to talk about complicated staffing committees, we're not going to do that today. House Bill 4200 is the Healthcare Employee Anti-Retaliation and Labor Act, or the HEAL Act. The Baker Hospital Review recently published an article finding that Minnesota was number three in the nation for the search term nurse burnout. In a survey of 2,403 nurses who left the bedside position in the previous year. The most cited reasons for their departure were stress and burnout at 75%. And chronic understaffing at 71%. Nurses indicated that the number one condition needed to return to the bedside was improved staffing. The burnout is similar amongst other care professionals working in hospital and long-term care settings. This bill seeks to address the following trends in how Minnesota cares for patients in hospitals and long-term care settings. First, patient safety in Minnesota continues to decline as staffing levels decline. The MDH's 2022 adverse health, actually I think I meant 2023, adverse health events report cited 572 preventable events, including falls, medication errors, bed sores, wrong site surgery, and the misuse and malfunction of a medical device. Bed sores made up the vast majority of reported events. A recent study involving nearly 54,000 patients found that staffing levels correlated with bed sores. And numerous studies have connected unsafe staffing with adverse events more broadly. The second trend is that when staff speak up because they believe they cannot safely care for a new patient, they experience retaliation. And I would encourage the committee members to look at the letters that were submitted today. This retaliation includes being sent home, even when understaffed, not receiving vacation requests, verbal abuse, losing shifts in scheduling, and being put on challenging schedule with the least preferred shifts. It does not make sense that hospitals send staff home when they have just cited deep concerns over unsafe staffing levels that they believe place patients at risk. To combat these trends, this bill provides labor protections for direct healthcare workers in acute care settings when advocating for safe patient care. And I would just like to emphasize that they already do advocate for safe patient care on a daily basis. This bill simply provides labor protections for when they do so. Specifically, it prohibits retaliation against patient care staff when they reasonably believe that accepting a patient assignment would create unnecessary danger to a patient's life, health, or safety. This bill explicitly states that the language does not pertain when patients are in need of urgent medical care. To anticipate some questions that you might have, does this mean that patients don't receive care? No. This puts the responsibility on management to find patient care solutions instead of continuing to unreasonably burden the direct healthcare workers, placing patients in danger. Hospitals have the capability to do this if they choose. For example, hospitals regularly schedule elective surgeries that they don't have the staff to care for after they're released from surgery. We also know that hospitals use benchmarking in order to staff at lower levels in order to maximize margins. Another question that you might have is, what if hospitals don't have enough staff to meet the need? MDH reports that there are more nurses in Minnesota than ever before, yet they are leaving hospital jobs because of working conditions. We hear the same across all direct healthcare job categories. If hospital administrators do not create safe conditions for workers and patients, we will only see the number of direct healthcare workers fleeing the bedside increase. And this bill provides a solution. Last question that you might have I'd like to proactively address is, does this mean that workers can decline patients that they don't want to serve out of bias or a desire to avoid difficult patients? And the answer is no. This bill very explicitly prohibits discrimination through incorporation of the Minnesota Human Rights Act and does not prohibit discipline based on performance issues. So if somebody is not doing a good job with their patients, or if they're consistently refusing to work hard, or if they don't like certain types of patients, like, that's grounds for discipline, and that is absolutely okay. Rather, this just protects workers who are advocating for safe patient care. And I will point out that under the Nurse Practice Act, nurses already have a professional ethical obligation to do so. Nurses keep coming to the legislature, and they're saying that this is a crisis. And the legislature has refused to listen for decades. The status quo is driving nurses from the bedside, and it is placing patients at risk. There is broader healthcare workforce shortage, and we need the dedicated professionals who choose healthcare careers to remain in these roles. And as just a final comment, I just want to emphasize that this bill is about empowering workers who advocate for their patients. And it's about shifting the burden to provide adequate care from those without power, the immediate healthcare workers at the bedside, to those with the most power to do so, the hospital administrators. And lastly, I just want to say that, as I think all of you know, I'm very collaborative and open to continuing to work with people who might have input on this bill to make sure that it is the best it can be. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you for that introduction, Representative Feist. And before we go to testifiers, I do just want to remind everyone in the room, I should really say this before every hearing, but we don't allow any sort of clapping or outbursts or booing or anything like that. So just to ask the those in the audience, although these issues can become very emotional and so on, just to ask everyone to maintain decorum. So thank you. The first testifier I have on the list is John Welsh. And then next will be Elena Hain. So please, Elena Hain, so please be ready to come up after. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Liebing and committee members for this opportunity. My name is John Welsh, and I'm a registered nurse on the cardiac floor at Unity Hospital in Fridley. House File 4200, or the Healthcare Employee Anti-Retaliation Act, is a priority for MNA members because of the executives running our hospitals are creating unsafe staffing conditions that result in real harm to patients. And when nurses speak up about their assignments, too often they face retaliation and discipline. When nurses have to accept an unsafe assignment, their jobs and licenses are on the line. We know adverse events continue to rise every year. MDH's reports confirm it. The incidence of hospital-acquired pressure ulcers, or the large deep bed sores, had doubled in the last 10 years. After Keeping Nurses at the Bedside Act was defeated last year by Mayo Clinic's threats, hospitals took advantage by making staffing even worse. At my hospital, Allina Health severely cut back our nursing assistants and nurses in October. I'm working with more patients and I have fewer nursing assistants to help. The care we provide is suffering. In the 3 months since we reduced staffing, my small hospital has had 3 reportable hospital-acquired pressure ulcers. In the previous 6 months, it was 0. Nurses who speak up about it, though, become a target. A nurse at Cambridge Medical Center was harassed by her manager after she filed a concern for safe staffing form regarding staffing on the night shift. A group of nurses on the highly skilled step-down unit at United Hospital were all sent home and subjected to a disciplinary process after they sought additional help at the start of a shift. Hospital leaders were more willing to send nurses home and possibly harm patients than work with them to develop a safe plan of care. Under the Nurse Practice Act, a nurse has a duty not to accept an assignment they cannot safely provide care for. But under current law, a hospital can discipline a nurse for doing just that. This puts us in situations where we're choosing between keeping our jobs and protecting our licenses. As hospitals continue to make profit-driven decisions that result in unsafe staffing, patients need nurse advocacy more than ever. The HEAL Act will help prevent nurses and other healthcare workers from retaliation for responding to an unsafe assignment and allow us to provide the safe and dignified care our patients deserve. Thank you.
Thank you. Elena Hain, and then Adam Carlin. Welcome to the committee. Sorry if I'm butchering your name.
That's okay. Good morning, Chair Liebling and committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Elena Hain, and I am a registered nurse and the interim executive director at the Minnesota Nurses Association. More importantly, I am one of the thousands of registered nurses across Minnesota who gave up bedside nursing because of the constant pressures of unsafe staffing and the moral injury associated with hospitals prioritizing their bottom lines over patient care. Hospital bedside staff are in crisis. They are here today pleading for the real solutions that allow them to have the safety and security they need to do their jobs. Dozens of objective studies prove that appropriate staffing levels in hospitals lead to better patient outcomes. And as the number of patients per care team increases, so do higher rates of negative outcomes, such as pneumonia, shock, cardiac arrest, or urinary tract infections. Yet, shift after shift, as workers appeal to hospital leaders for help, for help with seriously unsafe staffing, they are often met with indifference at best. Instead of listening to nurses who are saying that in their professional opinions that they cannot safely care for an additional patient, hospitals are consistently telling nurses to make do. But making do isn't only causing further harm to your mother, father, grandparent, or even your child. In your materials today, you will see a story about how one Alina hospital chose to put mats on the ground and increase camera surveillance when a nurse and nursing supervisor expressed their concerns about staffing levels. Despite appropriately escalating the concern up the chain of command, the management team at this hospital determined that a few extra mats on the ground was less expensive than attempting to find another nurse to care for this patient. Cameras and mats weren't able to help that patient when they fell on the ground. And neither was the nurse whose patient assignment was already too much to handle. What if it was your loved one who fell? Are cameras and mats really acceptable solution for people in their most vulnerable state in these hospitals? Recently, one of Minnesota's largest hospital systems, Alina Health, went through a process called benchmarking. This is a process where a private consultant chooses a subset of hospitals across the United States and shares the average staffing levels and outcomes for each of the facilities. Upon receiving this information, Alina decided that they didn't need to provide staffing levels at the best of the hospitals that they're being compared to. They didn't even decide that they needed to provide staffing levels of those hospitals that are ranked at 75% or even 50%. Instead, Alina Health chose to benchmark at 40% the level of staff. This is why, despite claims of a nursing shortage, Alina facilities are now closing units and laying off nurses, if you can imagine that. And to make matters even worse, this all on top of a recent report by the Minnesota Department of Health shows that almost 13% increase in preventable patient safety events that result in death or permanent harm or severe temporary harm. As a nurse, this is not acceptable to me, and it isn't acceptable to the 22,000 nurses of the Minnesota Nurses Association. We are asking for your help. You have an opportunity with this bill to save patient lives and keep nurses at the bedside. We are here today asking for your help. Please do not leave us behind, and please vote yes for moving this bill today. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you for your testimony. Adam Carlin and then Melissa Fraudette. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, my name is Adam Carlin. I'm the Chief Nursing Officer at mHealth Fairview Southdale Hospital. I've been a registered nurse for 15 years, including 9 years in varying leadership roles. I'm proud to be a nurse leader, and I'm grateful for the opportunity to represent my colleagues today. To put it simply, I have grave concerns with Section 5 of the bill, which authorizes hospital nurses to unilaterally refuse with impunity to accept a patient. This provision has the potential to confine some of our most vulnerable patients, including those experiencing mental health crises, to our extremely busy emergency departments. This bill creates significant opportunity for individual bias to determine who receives care in our hospital, bias to which our nursing profession is not immune. On a personal level, as a member of the LGBTQ plus community, I am deeply concerned how this bias refusal could impact my care. High quality care requires a team, teams that work around the clock to create safe working environments for our patients and their colleagues, teams that work to determine the best location for patients under our care. This includes elective procedures, and to be clear, elective procedures would include things such as cancer surgery, open heart surgery, anything scheduled in advance. This means doctors, advanced practice nurses, therapists, and other members of the team working together in a delicate balance to properly care for patients. The legal sanction of patient refusal for one role within the broader healthcare team disrupts this delicate balance. It recklessly endangers patients and would significantly limit our ability to ensure reliable access to hospital care for all patients. Of concern, the authors of this bill have used the term retaliation to describe professional nursing accountability with respect to patient refusal. Minnesota already has strong whistleblower legislation with important protections for individuals who, in good faith, report situations in which the quality of healthcare services is in question. This law protects nurses that speak up. There is no substantive proof that there is widespread nurses who are raising legitimate patient concerns who are facing retribution from their employers. In fact, at Fairview, our safety always culture requires staff who have questions or concerns to speak up, to practice a questioning attitude, and to communicate clearly when there are issues. Authors of this bill have mistakenly confused retaliation for accountability. And in the case of Section 5, which gives nurses unilateral authority to refuse patients, this lack of accountability will create serious problems. It's important to consider the impact of this proposed provision will have on our underserved, marginalized, and vulnerable patients, patients that we care for in our hospitals every day. It is not a bridge too far to see this provision to be used to the extreme, giving people with conscious or unconscious bias the ability to pick or choose their patients, or further, clearing the way for mandatory staffing ratios through sanctioned patient refusal. We have existing whistleblower laws. We have existing internal processes and protocols to support safe care environments in our hospitals.
I have to ask you to wrap up, please.
We will continue to oppose this provision. Thank you.
Thank you. Melissa Fraudette and then David Klinaw. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning and thank you, Madam Chair, community members. My name is Melissa Fraudette, and I serve as the Executive Director and System Chief Nursing Officer for CentraCare. I've been a registered nurse for over 23 years and in leadership for 10. I would like to talk about how hospitals staff their units and how difficult it would be to operationalize the situation when and if a nurse refused a patient assignment. We take many things into account when we make patient assignments. Some of these factors include a nurse's skill set, expertise, and years of experience. This then is matched with a patient's acuity and complexity, along with their physical, spiritual, and psychosocial needs. Patient assignments may be altered based on patient condition and/or unit changes. All hospitals have staffing plans which are publicly reported, with quarterly information about actual staffing levels and number of patients served. Nursing units are staffed with core staffing patterns based on historical patient volumes and acuity. We know hospitals can become busier than normal. During periods of high census on nursing units, we can use float pool nurses, or staff may assist from other units where patient census may be lower than anticipated. In addition, nurses can be alerted for additional assistance when needed when nurses call in sick on a relatively short notice. There are times when we can anticipate higher volumes and can plan accordingly. For instance, our teams can huddle to look ahead at surgical volumes and staff above our core nurses' staffing patterns to account for the additional volume or for higher acuity or for patients with longer length of stays. This is different than a nurse refusing a patient assignment. Under this scenario, the nurse is already at work and chooses not to care for a patient. Charge nurses may be able to change that nurse's assignment, but that's not always possible based on their expertise or the expertise of other available nurses. Sometimes it's possible to bring in an additional nurse, but it may take time for that nurse to arrive, up to 60 minutes in some circumstances, and that leaves the patient without a nurse, which could lead to unsafe conditions for that patient. Hospitals have procedures in place to accommodate staffing requests. This is an issue which should not be put into statute. Resolution should be achieved through collaboration on nursing units. Thank you for your consideration of my comments, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you for your testimony. You. David Klinaw and then Brad Leto. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. I am David Klinaw, and I serve as the Volunteer Services Coordinator at the Minnesota Sex Offender Program in Moose Lake. Thank you for this morning's opportunity to testify in support of House File 4200 as a Minnesota Association of Professional Employees member. In my work, I support volunteers in providing spiritual and support group services, working directly with many colleagues and about 150 clients through a wide range of modalities in a therapeutic setting. Working with these clients is quite challenging, especially with high turnover and chronic understaffing. That said, I really enjoy the work and wish I did not need to be here today as tasks pile up and colleagues feel extra stress. I wish I was at my workplace confident in a consistently safe environment and a culture receptive to staff feedback concerning staffing and safety issues. Sadly, that has not been my daily experience, and I am not alone. I am here to speak for myself and colleagues from various bargaining units who frequently approach me about feeling caught between a rock and a hard place, having to do tasks when they do not feel safe, yet feeling if they refuse, they will be, quote, disciplined. This involves direct safety situations, but also being frequently forced to work double shifts, being reassigned repeatedly during shifts, and feeling discouraged from participating in union work. Colleagues have also shared extensively about the high turnover rate. They note that people leave when they feel they are given impossible tasks, inadequately supported, unfairly disciplined, or observe questionable discipline targeted toward people who speak up about safety issues. These factors make it more difficult to recruit or retain enough capable colleagues so we can deliver the high-quality programming needed to rehabilitate clients in an environment safe for everyone. Without sufficient capable and experienced staff, clients who may not be ready could be mistakenly released into the community. Also, clients with potential to do their work and return home can be delayed in their journeys with extra taxpayer cost. This bill would allow staff to request modified assignments without retaliation. It would provide therapeutic rehabilitative staff in state facilities overdue protections to confidently share both staff and patient safety concerns with their supervisors. After clients assaulted five colleagues at MSOP Moose Lake last year, it is clear the status quo does not work. Please support House File 4200. Please give patient care staff stronger, more secure voices in our workplaces. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Brad Leto. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, and committee members. My name is Brad Leto, and I'm the Secretary Treasurer of the Minnesota AFL-CIO, the collective voice of Minnesota's unions. And again, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. Obviously, I'm here to support House File 4200, the Healthcare Employee Anti-Retaliation Labor Act, the HEAL Act, and I thank Representative Feist for authoring this bill. I hear from the hospitals that they do not retaliate. You've also heard that they do. House File 4200 protects workers from retaliation for refusing to take on too many patients, as an additional assignment may create unnecessary danger to a patient's health, safety, and life. Let's say it's you that have one of your spouse, your son, your daughter, your whoever, and all of a sudden there's six or seven patients and you're the next one. And then the healthcare professionals are supposed to give you the same amount of time. I think that we know that's unlikely to happen. The bill also establishes a process before patient staff decline care, but if push comes to shove, they can decline a new patient. As Representative Feist mentioned, retaliation takes many forms: unfair scheduling, being sent home without pay, hard to believe when we have a shortage of nurses and other healthcare professionals, and being denied time off. It's obvious we do not have enough patient staff in this state. We have an even more acute shortage of BIPOC, Black, Indigenous, and People of Color patient care staff. Progress is being made as more BIPOC patient care staff are entering the field. Do we really want to jeopardize that process? Do we want to continue to overload the current RNs and other nurse assistants, LPNs, CNAs, and other patient staff and have even more healthcare professionals leave their jobs? Everyone has a breaking point with their jobs. The Minnesota AFL-CIO and the Minnesota Nurses Association, AFSCME, Councils 5 and 65, SEIU Healthcare Minnesota and Iowa, food and commercial workers, UFCW Local 1189, steel workers, USW, and MAPE, as you've heard, all support this bill. These unions believe that, again, everyone has a breaking point in their jobs. House File 4200 tries to alleviate that breaking point. The bill tries in one small way to heal the patient care system with protections for care workers on the front lines of the fight to improve our health care system for workers, patients, and families. The Minnesota AFL-CIO asks you to support 4200. Thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Leto. Appreciate it. Okay, well, that is the end of the list of scheduled testifiers, so I think we can move to member discussion. So, Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And earlier on, it was said that we haven't been listening and taken care of, and frankly, the majority of information we heard on the previous session was dominated by an entity that represents less than 18% of the nurses. And actually, it might be lower now because I know several hospitals have voted to, the nurses voted to not have them represent. So I wish we had a more balance. But we just heard, give, you're the sixth one, and because of staffing, they're not going to give you as much time. So this bill's solution is that then you're turned away because the staff will say, nope, I'm not going to help because we're understaffed. The complaints about understaffing, the bodies rejected participating in a nurses' compact, which would allow nurses from multiple states to be able to fill out openings. And I think that that should be a bit of a priority of actually trying to build the staffing to care for the patients. And, there was a disparaging thing about a world-renowned entity and threats and this and that. Well, frankly, if we want to make decisions appropriately, we should have a study that shows over the last 10 years at hospital locations the type of issues that have been incidentally picked up anecdotally here. And let's see the patterns and comparison between the different systems, because there may be things that some entities are doing as a medical team, which is more effective than this approach that we're battling over. So, frankly, we should be addressing the underlying causes, such as the low reimbursement rate from government programs, the lack of staffing, and I don't see this bill addressing that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Bonner.
Thank you. I was going to ask some questions, but I'm just going to save us some time and talk about this. Everyone here knows my mom is a nurse, 43 years at the county. One of the most difficult facilities in the state. And we've heard these accusations that nurses are going to willy-nilly refuse an assignment. That is baloney. Let's call it what it is. Every nurse goes into nursing to do their absolute best, to deliver the best patient care every single shift, day after day, hour after hour, minute after minute. That is what they do. There are nurses that will constantly work to make do if they are short-staffed. So that is nonsense. If they are short-staffed, nurses will step up and they will pitch in and they will help each other out. That's what they do. They do it every day. What we're talking about here is when a nurse feels that there is a serious risk to a patient's health and safety due to unstaffed staffing, that they have a right to stand up and call it out. That is what we were talking about here today. This assertion that nurses would not hold up to their obligations or to do the right thing is ridiculous. And frankly, it's insulting. And I just have to say, this issue is not a new one. It has been around for decades, and it continues to be a continual problem. And until we find an actual solution, potentially this bill is going to continue. So let's just get it done.
Bonner. So we're going to have New Brindley, Schumacher, Baker, Smith, and then we'll go on to the next bill. So Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Feist, I'm wondering, you know, in your opening remarks, you had said that this will not apply to nurses who are denying taking patients on every shift, or if they are the only nurse who refuses to take a patient. You sort of indicated that all these things that it doesn't cover. And I'm wondering if you can just show me in the language where those things are sort of exempted and that is not allowable under this language.
Representative Feist.
Yeah, thank you. I was riffing a bit. but basically what this bill protects is very specific actions that are already protected under whistleblower law and already required for nurses under the Nurse Practice Act. And so at line 4.20, it talks about this is about when a nurse or a patient care staff reasonably determines that accepting that additional patient assignment is unsafe for that patient. And that is the only scenario that this covers. So if a hospital has reason to believe that the nurse is not being reasonable, like we're creating an objective legal standard through this bill that doesn't exist currently under law. So if they're not behaving reasonably, if there is reason to believe based on that nurse's pattern of practice that they are acting out of bias or laziness, you know, or every Friday they just happen to not, you know, feel like this patient assignment is safe, you know, they will have the ability to, like, look at the whole picture, of the nurses, you know, and patient care staff's, like, pattern of behavior and take action as necessary. And this bill is really specifically laid out to cover just that reasonable belief that patient assignment would be unsafe. And, again, that is behavior protected under whistleblower law and the Nurse Practice Act.
Follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Feist, as I read this, and I think I've read it pretty thoroughly, it looks like the patient care staff member is the sole determiner of what is reasonable. Multiple times the language is used, if the patient care staff reasonably determines. So that is at the sole discretion, and maybe this just needs to be cleaned up a little bit in language, but right now the way it reads in multiple locations of the bill, it is at the sole discretion of the patient care staff person, and they reasonably determine. And I know you're saying that that's an objective standard, but the way this is written, there could be five nurses on a floor and one of them reasonably determines that it is unsafe, but the other four could say, well, I think it's fine and I'll take the patient. And there is no mechanism to take that into consideration. And in fact, it's clearly laid out in the beginning of the bill, the prohibited actions about retaliation. The only exception to that is subdivision 4. And when you go down to subdivision 4, that just ensures that they can have a labor representative. It does not give any indication of the fact that if four other nurses on the floor reasonably determine that it is safe, that this individual who believes it is unsafe is wrong. There's no mechanism, and I'm just saying, in plain language, I understand what your intention is, and that may be noble, but that is not what your language does. Your language gives all power to an individual when there may be 5 or 10 other people saying they're just wrong. They're just wrong. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Well, thank you, Representative New Brindley. And I just want to point out, this is going to the Labor Committee, and the part of the bill that I think you're referencing is actually, I think, under the labor statutes. And so I think some of these issues are the very ones that will be discussed in the Labor Committee, because I don't know that we here deal with this exactly. So, you know, but appreciate your concern. I appreciate your concern. I think that's an issue that is a legal standard that exists already and will be fleshed out. I'm going to go to Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my first bit of questions, well, actually, it's an assumption that this applies to state and municipal-run hospitals as well. So my first question would be that on the fiscal note, and if that's been requested and where the status of that might be.
Representative Feist?
It has been requested and not yet received.
Okay. Thank you for that. I'll look forward to that. The only other question I had for today's hearing on this is, Representative Feist, you mentioned in your introduction, and then I didn't hear about it again, but you were talking about long-term care and how this also applies to them. I see on page 3, lines 22 through 24, that they would be included with that, and any facility licensed under the Commissioner of Health. With long-term care specifically, there, everything is referenced to patients. There's no reference to residents in here. And my question is, if it does apply to long-term care, like it reads like it does, how will this work with the new CMS regulations that we're expecting this summer regarding the 24-hour RN policies? And what other facilities, it looks like those lines are comprehensive, but what other facilities are out there besides the hospitals that we've been hearing about today? Thank you.
Representative Feist.
Yeah, thank you for the question. I'm going to answer it, and then if somebody else says I answer it incorrectly, they can step up. And but this only applies to acute care settings, so it is more narrow than that. And I do know that in the drafting that we struggled with, obviously patients and residents would both be covered. And so we could look at trying to reflect that more clearly in the definition section, but that was the intent. But again, it's only acute care settings.
Okay. All right, Representative Backer. Oh, I'm sorry. Let's go to Ms. Clarkvist for a second.
Madam Chair and members, I just wanted to point out on lines 4.24 and 4.25, it says that Subdivision 1 at least does not apply to nursing homes, ICFs, DD, and boarding care homes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Backer. Not Baker. Sorry.
Yeah, you know, it happens. So thank you. Also, I asked for a roll call vote.
Okay, roll call.
My question here, I can't quite see you. I'm way back here, Representative. But as an EMS, EMT personnel, when I look at this bill, this is how I interpret it. And so I'm looking for some insight. As an EMT, I can't refuse care. Doesn't matter. The challenges that we face on a traumatic run or a suicidal or mental health, behavioral health issue, I can't refuse it. Emergency departments can't refuse providing care. But when I look at this bill, that is what I see, is that nurses can refuse care. So I can't do it as an EMS. If I would do, I would be taken through the EMS RAB board and so forth, which had happened to me once. It wasn't a refusal. It was just miscommunication with the family. I've been through the whole process, but the nurses can do this. And that's what concerns me, because I volunteer to provide care. So help me with that question, please. And that's the only question I have, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Feist.
Yeah, thank you. So just to confirm, oops, sorry, I'll go back to my mic, then I won't be able to see you. But just to confirm, we do have a specific language about emergency medical situations, so that is a carve-out. But I just want to emphasize again that we are not creating new behavior or a new right. Like, people are already protected under the whistleblower protections for doing what is laid out in this bill. And again, just to emphasize, the Nurse Practice Act actually requires that when nurses feel that a patient assignment is unsafe, they have an obligation to say so. What we're doing is we're providing labor protections for something that patient care staff already do at great risk to their own careers and in order to stand up for the patient. So we are creating labor protections for something that people already do, but honestly, a lot of people are afraid of retaliation. And again, the goal is to shift the burden for ensuring that hospitals and care facilities are safely staffed from the bedside care professional, who have the least power to make macro level changes, to the hospital administrators, who have that power and authority.
Okay, thank you. And so Representative Nadeau, you raised your hand kind of after I was going to kind of conclude this
really fast.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. And it was one of the answers that I wasn't going to speak to the bill, but there's a conflict, it seems to me. I was going to ask about line 4.24, where it's not applying to nursing facilities, ICFs, developmental disabilities, licensed boarding homes. And then you had one of your answers said it only applies to acute care hospitals. That's it. Acute settings.
Yeah.
Okay. And then if I look in 5.22, that's where it seems to me that the conflict occurs. And I know that the intent here is to apply to state-operated services, I'm guessing. But it just seems to me that there's a conflict in where this can be applied and where it can't be applied. Can you just quickly answer that for me?
Representative.
Yep, thank you. I don't know that I can quickly answer it for you, but I'm happy to connect with you offline to go over it to make sure that there isn't a conflict. I think the intention at line 4.24 was to make it clear where it did not apply. And so it might be something, I'm a big fan of making implicit things explicit just to make sure that it's not unclear. So I'm happy to connect with nonpartisan staff and to make sure that that is really explicitly clear.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Nadeau. Representative Smith?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be quick. My clarifying question here, there's been a lot of talk about potentials of nurses, not wanting to provide care. And as I listened to some of our testifiers, some of the written testimony here, Ryan Hilmo, who's an RN who has a letter in here, stated specifically that his entire cardiac unit was dismissed for the day without pay when they raised questions about this. Another testifier mentioned, I think it was Mr. Welsh, about being sent home several times. To me, that kind of sounds like a forced refusal of patient care from the management side of things. So my question is maybe just clarifying when these nurses are maybe we don't want to use the loaded term, retaliated against, but are told to go home. We're all concerned with patient care. What happens to the patients in the units when those nurses are sent home those days?
Representative Feist.
Yep, thank you. That's a really good question. I could answer it like in abstractions, but would one of our nurses like to come up and provide an example?
Okay, we're really pressed for time, though.
Sorry. I can say the short answer is that patients don't receive care, and in fact, they receive less care than they even would have. It looks like we have an expert.
Okay.
We'll be fast.
Okay, welcome. Please state your name again for the record.
John Welsh from M&A. In that instance, the night shift was asked to stay later.
Yeah, all right. Thank you. Thank you very much. All right. With that, Representative Feist, do you have like a 15-second closing?
Sure, 15 seconds. This is a really important labor bill, and I urge members to support it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. So Ms. Mierenhopper will take the roll on the bill. So I'm going to renew my motion that House File 4200 be re-referred to the Committee on Labor and Industry, Finance, and Policy.
Chair Liebling.
Aye.
Liebling, aye. Vice Chair Bierman.
Bierman, aye.
Bierman, aye. Lee Schumacher.
Schumacher, no.
Schumacher, no. Representative Akam.
Akam, aye.
Akam, aye. Representative Backer.
Backer, no.
Backer, no. Representative Bonner.
Proudly, aye.
Bonner, aye. Representative Carroll.
Aye.
Carroll, aye. Representative Elkins.
Elkins, aye.
Elkins, aye. Representative Fisher.
Fisher, aye.
Fisher, aye. Representative Hemmingson-Yeager.
Aye.
Hemmingson-Yeager, aye. Representative Herr.
Herr, aye.
Herr, aye. Representative Keel.
No.
Keel, no. Representative Murphy.
No.
Murphy, no. Representative Nadeau.
No.
Nadeau, no. Representative New Brindley.
No.
New Brindley, no. Representative Perryman.
No.
Perryman, no. Representative Kwan.
No.
Kwan, no. Representative Ryer.
Ryer, aye.
Ryer, aye. Representative Smith.
Aye.
Smith, aye.
There being 11 ayes and 8 nays, the motion prevails and the bill is re-referred to the Committee on Labor. Okay, thank you, Representative Feist. And then we're going to take up the Ryer bill next, which is House File 4210, And Representative Breyer has a, so Representative Breyer's motion is that House File 4210 be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary. And there is a DE1-1 amendment. And Representative Breyer, I assume you want to move the DE1-1 amendment.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, to put the bill in the order in which she would like to discuss it. And Representative Breyer, do you want to say a word or two about what the DE amendment changes before we adopt it?
Yes, I would. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll highlight the major changes. First of all, throughout, there's a wording change where in the original version, we referred to behavioral health crisis intervention teams. That wording created an incorrect impression that it was related to behavioral health care. We've made it more general to a violence interruption intervention team to better clarify the intent of the bill. We also removed lines 113 through 116, the standards for emergency rooms, because I heard and agree that that's unworkable. On the original bill.
1.13?
Mm-hmm. Yep, standards for emergency rooms. We added more conditions and information around the de-escalation teams, including allowing hospitals to use processes that they're already using as long as they meet the criteria or adapting their current approach and put out timelines that were judged to be sufficiently reasonable, not immediate training for everyone. Those are outlined in the bill. That goes in right before 3.3 in the original bill.
Right. So, Representative Breyer, so my understanding is that the changes are the result of your work with a lot of different parties, and so let's go ahead and adopt this, and then we can discuss more what the bill does, and you know, questions can be asked at that point. So, Representative Breyer is moving the DE1-1 amendment. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. The DE1-1 is adopted. So, Representative Breyer, to your bill as amended.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair, and to Representative New Brindley and others, I'll call it out where there have been changes.
And so, before you go on, Representative Breyer, I would appreciate if members didn't, like, shout out in committee. We asked the audience to preserve decorum, and they are doing a very excellent job. I think members could do likewise. Thank you. Please proceed.
Thank you, Chair Liebling and members. We all deserve a safe workplace. That's why I'm pleased to author House File 4210, the Hospital Safety Bill, as amended. This bill is offered in response to the increasing violence in hospitals, which has, in turn, resulted in many nurses leaving the bedside rather than having to cope with these high-risk and stressful working conditions. We have requested a fiscal note, but also have done all we can, including removing a grant program in the DE amendment, so that we can stay focused on the policy side rather than building ongoing funding requirements. The bill builds on and integrates with steps taken in last year's Nurse and Patient Safety Act, which made important improvements to training, action planning, and reporting of violent workplace incidents. It moves us to a more systemic solution rather than piecemeal approaches. Before I talk about the bill in more detail, I want to talk about the bill process this far. It's a bill that raises strong feelings, especially from nurses, hospitals, and advocates for healthcare issues, including mental health. And for that reason, we've been having many conversations, and I've received valuable feedback from a wide range of sources. I know that for all involved, the safety of healthcare workers and patients and the well-being of hospitals is paramount. That's why the emphasis is on being flexible to build on what hospitals and communities are already doing while providing the structure and standards needed to provide a safe environment for caregivers and patients. Now, about the bill's main provisions. The hospitals must provide de-escalation training to most healthcare workers.
added in the DE. Certain standards are outlined, and hospitals are permitted to create their own course or use an existing course as long as it meets the criteria in the bill. The bill establishes violence interruption intervention teams, the renamed teams, to increase the resources available in hospitals to assist with violent incidents. The requirements differ by hospital size and type. For example, critical access hospitals have a more modest requirement compared to larger hospitals. That is another addition in the DE amendment. The teams must have at least one member on site at all times who's a licensed medical professional who's authorized to administer all medications that may be required during a crisis intervention, and they must be available to respond promptly. For larger hospitals, a team must include at least four members. The specifics of team composition continue to be discussed and fine-tuned. This team would be called on when the de-escalation training that all staff have gone through is insufficient to cope with a crisis. So it's not the first step that would be taken. It's a phased approach. And then following incidents, debriefs and learning sessions are required with specific roles for the care team in the hospital. Hospitals must put violence interruption interventions policies in place, develop safety procedures, provide training, and have an implementation plan. Enforcement and limited immunity provisions are also included in the bill, hence its journey to judiciary. Employees need to have access to a secure online portal to report threats or violent incidents, and a log will be created with information about patients who leave the ED after checking in, but before receiving care. A gap in the data that we currently have and that's being collected. This is a comprehensive bill, and I've been encouraged that people on all sides of the issue have been able to move toward common ground on many of the issues. The scope of the changes in the DE amendment is testimony to that. My commitment is to continue working with all stakeholders and my legislative colleagues to deliver a solution that helps address the challenging problem of workplace violence in hospitals that all are struggling with. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you, Representative Ryer. So first person on the list to testify is Sarah Baker, and then Tammy Hayes, and then Melissa Fritz. So you would come on down, and then if the others would be prepared to hop right in, we can save some time. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Liebling and committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning. My name is Sarah Baker, and I am a registered nurse at Abbott Northwestern on the Child Adolescent Psychiatric Unit. With hospital unit closures, the units that have remained open have been forced to adapt to the increased acuity or healthcare needs, and in the midst of that, many units have also experienced cuts to their staffing grid. This has left nurses to pick up the extra workload and absorb the increased risk of violence when patient acuity becomes concentrated to one place. And as patients become upset with the lower standard of care nurses are able to provide. I have experienced the effects of this firsthand. Since Alina's decision to close the adolescent unit at United Hospital, we have seen a steady increase on my unit in acuity. This has left us feeling burnt out from dealing with challenging behaviors constantly and putting ourselves at risk as we have to respond to violence and threats of violence far more often. I have already watched multiple coworkers experience workplace injuries as a result of this. At Abbott, whenever a behavioral code occurs anywhere in the hospital, each of the four mental health units is expected to send one or more of our own staff members to the code, and at least one must send a nurse to lead the code. So on top of a full patient assignment, I or one of my coworkers is expected to respond to an event that is occurring on the other side of the hospital. It takes me or a different nurse away from our patient assignment for an unknown amount of time, leaving coworkers to pick up the extra work in the meantime. Worse than that, we often experience behavioral codes on the mental health units. And if a code occurs on our unit while four staff members are already responding to one elsewhere, it leaves us at a huge disadvantage with very few staff members available to respond, which means our unit can become unsafe for both patients and staff. Having a violent interruption crisis response team available would make a huge difference at my hospital. It would mean that mental health nurses and staff members could focus on our own patients and be available to help respond to codes within mental health. It would also benefit the non-mental health floors because there would already be a trained unit, preferably much closer to the main hospital, who is experienced in responding to behavioral codes. I have experienced the benefits of having or being the RN who leads a code using verbal de-escalation, and it makes such a difference to patients when we are able to use this type of trauma-informed approach because it means we are putting the patient and their experience first rather than focusing solely on their behavior. I think having a violent interruption crisis response team would provide patients all over the hospital with this type of dignified care, and the nurses on that team would be able to put all of their focus on helping the patient in front of them rather than having to worry about a patient load that they are neglecting on their own unit. Thank you.
Thank you. Tammy Hayes, and then Melissa Fritz, and then Maria Raines. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Tammy Hayes, and I am the Chief Nurse Executive at Northfield Hospital and Clinics. I've been a registered nurse for 40 years and have served in this position for 17. Northfield Hospital is licensed as a 37-bed hospital with an average daily census of 18. We are slightly larger than a critical access hospital, which under federal guidelines must be 25 beds or less. We do not offer inpatient mental health services and have no mental health professionals on staff. We would not meet the requirements of having the behavioral health crisis intervention team as outlined in this proposed bill. But we have had in place a behavioral emergency response team, or BERT, since October 2012. This process was developed with the resources we currently have in the facility and is functioning well. Our BERT team, as well as our other care direct caregivers, are required to have de-escalation or CPI training. There is no flexibility in this law. This new team would need to consist of at least four people with three licensed medical professionals who have experience and competency in providing psychiatric care. The team must be available at all times and would not be allowed to have any other patient assignments. Northfield Hospital is one of the many hospitals in Minnesota that had a negative operating margin last year. I only mention this because it would be a significant cost to the hospital, and it's doubtful we could even recruit these positions. At Northfield Hospital, we had 29 incidents of violence last year. Our current team has responded. This is too many, but we're glad to have our BERT team to support our staff during these difficult times. But given the number, the crisis team would be called upon once every 13 days. I want to close by just reminding each of you about the violence prevention mandates and activities that were just passed into law last year with the Nurse and Patient Safety Act. We are embracing this work. The first reports with the incident response action plans are due to MDH January 1st of 2025. This will allow data about violence and indicate what additional steps may be necessary. Please let this process work. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Melissa Fritz. And then Maria Raines, and then Jason Thompson. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Melissa Fritz, and I'm the Chief Nursing Officer at Methodist Hospital in St. Louis Park. I've been a registered nurse for 17 years and have been serving in this role the last 2 years. Methodist Hospital does not provide inpatient mental health services either. However, we have put together our own security alert response team to meet the needs of our patients and our staff members. It is an approach that would not meet the specific criteria outlined in this proposal. However, it's working incredibly well, and importantly, was created in close consultation and collaboration with our direct care team members. Security alert responses include members of the flying squad, which are critical care trained nurses who do not have patient assignments. They circulate throughout the hospital, and they're checking in with our care team members as well as our patients. The flying squad team members have received de-escalation training both in person and also through additional e-learnings. Our members of the response team include the charge nurse of the unit, the administrative nursing supervisor, the house resident, the orderly, the spiritual care team, and security. We strongly believe that every member of our response team has important skills and insights to provide and would not want any of them to be prohibited from helping in a crisis. I urge lawmakers to provide much more flexibility in the criteria for these crisis teams. Current law, passed just this last session, requires the Department of Health to analyze workplace violence and create a report by January 1, 2025. I encourage lawmakers to review that important work once it is completed, consider the best practices that our state hospitals have developed for themselves, and then incorporate those lessons. If we rush into a set of requirements without taking the time to understand what is already being done, we're likely to end up prohibiting many effective and innovative strategies already being completed. Every day at every hospital in Minnesota, our care teams are doing the work of building better systems, better responses, and better outcomes. Please do not cut that work short with a series of restrictive mandates. I think scoping the requirements of the de-escalation training would be helpful as well. 4 hours of de-escalation training is extremely expensive and time-consuming to provide to workers who have zero to minimal contact with patients or the public. This amount of training is certainly going to be helpful for our employees whose roles are predominantly focused on contact with patients or even the public, like our registration staff who unfortunately deal with aggressive visitors. However, we do have many employees who may have passing contact with a patient whose roles are not focused on patients directly. A scaled back requirement would be more appropriate for these team members. We stand ready to work with a bill author to make changes to the bill towards our shared goal of staff and patient safety. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you for your testimony. Maria Raines and then Jason Thompson. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Maria Raines, and I serve as Vice President and Chief Nursing Officer for the University of Minnesota Medical Center and Masonic Children's Hospital and lead CNO for Fairview Health Services. I've been a nurse for about 26 years and served in nursing leadership for about 12 years. I appreciate the opportunity to share with you how we take an individual hospital approach, not a one-size-fits-all approach, to behavioral crisis intervention at our UMMC Riverside campus and more broadly across our healthcare system. The University of Minnesota Medical Center Hospital campus is one of the largest hospital systems in the state. On average, we care for almost 500 patients on our West Bank Riverside campus and about 300 patients on the East Bank campus. We are seeing a steady increase in the number of patients who arrive in our emergency departments without emergent medical needs, but for whom the appropriate level of care and supports are not available. Similarly, a significant number of patients remain in the hospital after it is medically needed due to a shortage of step-down care options across our state. The increasing number of these types of patients is important to this issue because they represent a significant driver of behavioral crisis events in our hospitals. So in sharing this experience, I must first call attention to the root causes that are sending and keeping so many in our community hospitals unnecessarily, and the very real contribution this trend has had on behavioral incidents and other acts of violence in our hospitals. In response to these trends, our teams are working to meet the unique needs and environments in each of our hospitals, which vary in size from a few patients to over 800. Each of our hospitals have different emergency response teams based on the needs of the individual facilities. At our Riverside campus, we have a BERT team because of the patient population we serve. We designed this team based on the staffing complement that we have. We simply cannot replicate this type of team across our system based on the unique staffing at each of the community hospitals we have. This bill doesn't account for the fact that many acts of violence result from patients experiencing acute delirium and other medical conditions, which require a medical response, not a behavioral crisis response. The inability to have other care team members provide a response severely limits the ability to meet the clinical needs of our patients.
I have to ask you to wrap up, please.
In closing, I want to reinforce that hospitals in Minnesota are working hard every day to eliminate incidents of violence in our hospitals. We are instituting de-escalation training at UMMC and expanding to other hospital sites. We want to continue to work with the hospital author, the bill author, and we want to understand the frustrations that our patients are facing so that we can also address these circumstances. I have no doubt that expanding capacity of direct care and treatment and improving access to community-based service will help alleviate a lot of the behavioral incidents that are happening. Thank you, Representative Ryer, for your willingness to continue discussions on this bill.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Jason Thompson. Welcome.
Welcome. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Jason Thompson, and I am the Workplace Violence Program Coordinator for CentraCare Health System. CentraCare is made up of 9 hospitals, ranging from our largest in St. Cloud to our smallest in Benson. Out of the 9 hospitals, 3 of them have inpatient mental health services, and 4 of our hospitals have security. CentraCare takes workplace violence very seriously. As healthcare workers, we face the unique challenge of dealing with workplace violence. Workplace violence will always exist in healthcare. Patients experiencing delusions, withdrawal symptoms such as alcohol, drug, and the opioid crisis, dementia, pain contribute to this complex issue. It's important to note that workplace violence isn't limited to mental health cases. It affects various departments, with most of our events occurring in emergency rooms, orthopedics, telemetry, neurology, medical and surgical units, and the ICU. Our approach to handling workplace violence cannot be one size fits all. What works at St. Cloud Hospital will not be effective at Redwood Falls or Benson Hospitals. Unfortunately, this bill aims to create a cookie-cutter approach to behavioral crisis teams, which may not address the unique needs of different healthcare settings. CentraCare actively encourages reporting workplace violence incidents. However, determining whether we're experiencing more incidents or simply reporting them more diligently remains challenging. As the Workplace Violence Program Coordinator, I focus on the severity of events rather than the sheer numbers. We categorize incidents into severity levels ranging from near misses, a level 1, to significant injuries, a level 5. In 2022, we had 25 level 5 severity events where employees were so significantly injured that they couldn't return to work or needed modified duties. Thanks to interventions and recommendations, including those from the Nurse and Patient Safety Act established last year, we reduced that number to 3 in 2023. Despite these efforts, there's an aspect that this bill overlooks: the relationships we built with our security teams and local law enforcement. Our rural hospitals have fostered connections where law enforcement officers drop by for a cup of coffee and informal conversations during night shifts. These relationships contribute to a safer environment. I want to close by reading February's reported workplace violence incidents for each of our 9 hospitals that were reported to our record management system. St. Cloud Hospital had 66 events. One emergency room longtime mental health boarder had 7 of those incidents. He had another 6 in January and another 6 in December. He had assaulted 19 staff in 3 months. He could not be placed because of his level of aggression. We need help with our longtime mental health boarders. Wilmer Rice Memorial had 4 workplace violence events. Long Prairie Hospital had 2. Benson Hospital had 1. Redwood Falls Hospital had 0. Painesville Hospital had 0. Sauk Center Hospital had 0. Melrose Hospital had 0. And Monticello Hospital had 0. Certainly, utilizing a team of mental health professionals solely for medication administration and de-escalation techniques without other job duties is not the most efficient allocation of resources.
I have to ask you to wrap up, please. Way over time here.
Before adding further requirements, let's closely monitor the data and outcomes that come out of the Nurse and Patient Safety Act. By evaluating the impact, we can make informed decisions that prioritize both patient safety and the well-being of our already busy healthcare workers and mental health professionals. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, for allowing me to speak with you today.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. So we're going to go to member questions. Before we do that, I just want to say a word about the path of this bill. So this is going to judiciary because it does have a little judiciary piece in it. But our intention with this, just so members know and the public, is that it would really, the content are going to stay with us. So they're going to send the bill back to us if it clears judiciary, and so it would be laid over. So I just want members to know that, like, this is not like going on its own to the floor or anything like that, okay, as we continue. Because obviously there's going to be more work done here. So with that, Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm actually wondering if one of the testifiers, Ms. Hayes, would stand for a question. That would be great.
She can come down, but I do want to tell members if we don't get done, and we do have another bill, you know, we don't want to, like, repeat the testimony here. And if we're going to we're going to stay a little bit longer after the end of our time here to get through our agenda if we possibly can. So go ahead, Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. Hayes. I just wanted to clarify. I think you said that you serve a 37-bed hospital, and did you say your average census is 18?
Correct.
Thank you. And I'm wondering if you can tell us how many staff do you typically have on during one shift to care for those 18 patients?
The 18, yeah. Madam Chair, the 18 okay. patients are composed of both OB and med-surg, and usually on our medical surgical unit, we have six nurses and two aides, and then our OB unit, we usually have four nurses and an aide.
Representative Brindley, short follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So it sounds like you have 10 nurses on staff to serve those patients. So this bill would require a 40% increase in staffing, and that increased staffing could not be used to assist with anything else. They would just be there. And can you let us know, do you know how many incidents of violence you have at your hospital, how often that happens?
It was 29 in the hospital. Yeah.
In the year?
In a year.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much. Okay. Representative Kwan.
That's what made the point.
Yeah. Representative Kwan.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. First, on 113 of the DE, it says that you need to report this information to a union representative, but what do you do if it's a non-union hospital?
Representative Breyer.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, there would not be a union representative to report it to. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Representative Kwan.
Thank you. Then maybe some verbiage, if there is, then that'd be more clear. The big question I've got is you've got this team and you're defining the team. But how many teams are there? Are there 8-hour shifts, 12-hour shifts? How many shifts in a week? You're talking maybe a substantial number greater than, you know, a team has to have X number of people.
Representative Breyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative. We would need to have coverage for people because you don't know when violence is going to occur. So it would be ongoing 24/7 coverage. However, I do want to take this opportunity to point out that we have been talking about the concerns, for example, with Northfield Hospital. And I didn't have the data available yet, but it'll be coming to say, what are the groupings of hospitals? How do we define the appropriate level? I want to assure everyone that we are not looking for a cookie-cutter approach. We're looking for something that optimizes the spot between structure, flexibility, and the ability to work with the community.
Thank you, Representative Breyer. Very short, Representative Cromwell.
Right. Madam Chair, you know, my calculations with 7 day a week, you're talking at least a couple dozen people, if not more, because you do have vacation, etc. So it'd be nice to have you size the impact per site. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I think that's what she just said she's willing to do. So thank you very much. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Breyer. I want to talk a little bit about the violence interruption team. And then I want to talk about the differences in this bill and the Nurses and Patient Safety Act that we passed last year that we're going to wait and get. So the biggest thing that I'm looking at is this violence interruption intervention team. Why is there no involvement in the team? Why is the team excluding a security officer?
I'm sorry, Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm well trained. I would say that that's another area where it differs from community to community, how that's playing out, and it's open for discussion.
And thank you, Representative Ryer.
Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I hope that you can look at that. I mean, any places where you do have high incidence of violence in hospitals, I mean, I think there was a testifier that even talked a little bit about, you know, a lot of it has to do with opioids and meth and delirium. And there's not a lot of medical staff, and I've spent some time in these areas, that are going to go into a situation like that without security. And I just find it glaringly omitted in here. My next question has to do with the de-escalation training. Are you familiar with what hospitals are doing today with de-escalation training, and especially as it applies to the Nurse and Patient Safety Act that was just passed?
Representative Ryer.
I know. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm aware that de-escalation training, when it occurs and when it's in place, is very helpful. I hear a great deal of feedback from one-on-one from individuals about how useful it is, and I would like to see it be a widespread practice at a certain, you make sure that it's being thorough and complete.
Yeah. All right, last question, Representative Doe.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. If this is my last question, then I'm going to go to starting at subdivision 5 and on. This committee is incredibly aware of the challenges that hospitals that are care facilities face regarding, and Representative Klum alluded to this a little bit about reimbursements and staying afloat. We've got a lot of challenges out there right now. Shortly, we're going to be getting the first report on the Nurse and Patient Safety Act, and I'm looking at subdivision 5 and beyond, all the way to subdivision 8, all the way down. It's really to the end. It's really to the end. And as I look at this, this is the legislature standing up and saying, in my opinion, we're the experts in hospital administration. And we're not the experts in hospital administration. We have requested a lot of information in the Nurse and Patient Safety Act, and there's a lot of redundancies between these two. I didn't do a side by side on them, but there's a lot. And why do we want to insert ourselves in this case and assume that hospitals don't want to reduce violence, they don't want to do de-escalation, but we want to put an enormous amount of administrative burden on hospitals to comply with something in statute that we've already asked, they're readily supplying, and they have the same goal that the nurses do, that we do, that their doctors do in reducing violence in their hospitals. No one wants violence to occur in their hospitals. But this is so heavy-handed. You said you want to have flexibility working with the community. There's no flexibility here. This is a one-size-fits-all. It doesn't matter if you have two patients or if you have 5,000 patients. This is a one-size, heavy approach. And I'm wondering if we can work on trying to reduce the workload, the administrative burden that this is going to place on our hospitals.
All right. So thank you. I think that was kind of a rhetorical question. And given that, I think Representative Ryer has indicated that she's very open to working. And I think so the answer would be yes if it isn't just a rhetorical question. So with that, Representative Ryer is going to renew the motion to re-refer House File 4210 as amended to the Judiciary Committee. All in favor, please say aye.
My hand was up for roll call.
And the motion of all opposed. Anyone opposed?
No.
The motion prevails, and the bill is on its way. I'm sorry, I didn't see your hand, and we're in the middle of a vote. So we are going to now take up the next bill. Very briefly, we're probably not going to get through it, but we do have a testifier who came a long way to testify, and so we're going to take up Representative Smith's bill. And that is, let's see.
3700.
We are House File 3700. So Representative Smith is going to move that House Bill 3700 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. So Representative Smith? Oh, and there's an author's amendment.
There's an author's amendment.
Yes, there's an author's amendment. And that is the A1, I think it was. This was the A1 amendment, just to put it in the order in which he'd like to have it reviewed. So A1 amendment is moved by Representative Smith. All in favor of adoption of the A1, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment's adopted to your bill. Representative Smith, if you can be really brief, because we're going to lay it over and we will come back to it. So.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I will be brief because I want some of our testifiers to be able to testify. Simply put, this is trying to bring clarity to a hard situation where hospitals close and to empower local communities with tools to help make decisions in that very difficult time. So I will just suffice to say that and ask testifiers to be given most of the time.
All right. Thank you, Representative Smith. So we have Cassie Heidi. Welcome to the committee. Come on down.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee, and thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to testify. My name is Cassie Heidi, and it is both a privilege and an honor to serve as the city administrator for the city of Fauston. I have dedicated nearly 18 years of service to my community, and I'm grateful for the opportunity to continue serving Fauston and to be here today. Fauston's in northwest Minnesota along U.S. Highway 2 between Grand Forks, North Dakota, and Bemidji, Minnesota, for those of you who aren't aware. Our city stands as a beacon of progress, growth, resilience, and prosperity. With a population of just over 1,400 individuals, we proudly serve a larger community of approximately 20,000 people in our area. And we have a reputation as a healthcare hub. We have 3 dentists, an eye clinic, chiropractor, 2 pharmacies, 2 assisted living facilities, 2 nursing homes, and a critical access 25-bed hospital and clinic. I'm grateful and proud to support House File 3700. As city administrator, I've witnessed firsthand the critical need for the proposed revisions in this bill. Fauston Hospital was a municipal hospital from the late 30s, early 40s, until 93, when the city formed the nonprofit First Care Medical Services, which operated the hospital as such until 2009, when it affiliated with Essentia Health. Prior to signing the affiliation agreement in 2009, an 18-month negotiation period ensued, culminating in a robust agreement guaranteeing access to essential care and core services, notably OB care, which were clearly outlined and secured. In May of 21, local hospital administration informed the city that the OB program was pausing for 120 days for a need to hire additional nursing staff. Upon this news, I worked with the city council and mayor to form an OB task force. We quickly had 14 community stakeholders willing to participate with the goal to work to assist Essentia in unified and consistent messaging regarding the current pause of OB labor delivery services at Essentia Health Fauston while working collaboratively and creatively to find a solution to successfully reset OB services in Essentia. The task force met early mornings before work days with local and regional Essentia leadership. After 12 months of meetings and meeting the goalposts that were set in front of us, we soon began to realize that Essentia did not intend for our OB to resume in Fauston, and worked to create a problem they hoped our community would see them trying to fix. Fortunately, because of the hard-fought, solid agreement leadership in 2009-1, the city has a remedy to ensure that our community members have the access to care that they deserve and need. To that end, our city is currently working towards arbitration with Essentia, which is scheduled for July 8th through 11th this year. We intend to gain local control back of First Care Medical Services, which still holds the hospital license and owns the real estate. We acknowledge this monumental challenge ahead of us, and while it might be easier to step aside and allow Essentia continue to make decisions that diminish rural health services and centralize care in their larger facilities, it's not the right course of action for Fauston and the communities we serve.
I have to ask you to wrap up.
Yes. Please. What makes this revised bill so important is seeing what Essentia has was allowed to do in Foston with little to no repercussions or accountability to the communities they serve. Essentia Health's mandated hearing under the current bill was held via Teams 606 days after babies stopped being delivered in Foston. The current bill points to a provision where there's a potential $1,000 fine, and to my knowledge, Essentia's not even been asked to pay that. Over 200 people attended that MDH hearing with more than 40 people at City Hall. Our questions were limited, and the moderator coached Essentia leadership on several questions. The individuals who attended the meeting at City Hall left feeling just as disheartening as when they came. The language in this bill will fulfill what I believe the original intent behind its passage really was, and that's providing the public with the notice and transparency they deserve. It will ensure healthcare corporation execs engage directly with the community, facing the individuals in their communities whose lives are impacted by their decisions. This bill will institute penalties that actually carry weight for multi-billion dollar nonprofits, ensuring accountability and consequences. Finally, the language in this bill empowers local governments to shape the future of healthcare within their communities. Local governments have an intimate understanding of community needs that far surpasses those of corporate executives whose profits often exceed the general fund budget of the communities they serve.
Need you to
conclude. I thank you, Madam Chair, for and members of the committee for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Thank you for making the trip.
Yes.
So we have several other people who want to testify on the bill, but we are really out of time. So, Representative Smith, is there anyone else who traveled to be here?
No, and since it's being laid over, please feel free
okay.
to come at me with questions.
All right, so members, what we're going to do, obviously we don't have time for discussion today, but we won't do anything with this bill until we bring it up. We'll repost it. We'll have the rest of the discussion and the rest of the testimony on this bill. So at this time, I'm going to lay over House File 3700. So we will, so there we are. So. Thank you very much, everybody. And so with that, the meeting is adjourned.